Yeah, I think it's just another example of like where the power structure really doesn't know what it's doing. And like they're kind of like dancing in the dark as much as we are. And I mean that was like they really I watched Century of the Self the other night, or at least the first two parts of it again. And they have this notion that they're projecting where it's like the elite look at the masses like they're just being ruled by these unconscious forces, and that they have no real free will, you know, and that they're just kind of like, you know, unpredictable and, you know, kind of reckless. But then I'm just like, how are the people analyzing these people exempting themselves from the very same forces that they're saying that the masses are portraying? Like, why is it that they can be trusted more, especially when they're showing all the same psychotic neuroses that the public is? It's kind of weird. They're like analyzing the people like, oh, you guys are messed up, you know? And it's like, well, you're fucking messed up. Like, we're all messed up. We're in this together, you know? It's not like the elite has something that, you know, I mean, I don't know.
People who obsess over mind control seem to be the most susceptible to it themselves.
That's
That's
true.
all I can really notice.
Yeah, I mean, Amy was successfully hypnotized for a long period by a psychic, and Amy had been trained in hypnosis to learn how hypnosis works and everything. And she at the time, I don't think she is anymore, really. She was extremely susceptible. And what is that about? Like, I mean, that's my feeling with Scientology, is that it's just like kind of a way to distinguish who's the most susceptible to hypnosis, and then so that they're in a position to use them. It's kind of like a filtering system to gather up the recruits, you know. I feel like there's a very strong argument for that. And then that's L. Ron Hubbard's whole deal. And then watching Rosemary's Baby when she's given the concoction for the inception, you know, that in itself is showing kind of like a hypnosis, and she's kind of like coming out of the hypnosis, even though she's put under, and she's like, this isn't a dream, this is really happening. We're also in a position watching that, where we're being subject to a form of hypnosis. But the fact that they have this naval officer standing there, and that Scientology came out of the Navy, and the people involved and everything, it's very curious.
Yeah, well, you've got the Pope, and you've got the Scientology, and you've got all these different kind of phenomena of the outer church, I guess.
Right.
And
Yeah.
it's really interesting how we obsess over these movies by like a guy who like literally raped a girl.
Yes. Yeah.
Weird.
It is weird.
I always thought it was weird.
Well, you're right to think that it's weird, because it is.
There's an 11-year-old actress in The Tenant, and she was in Playboy. Her mother took nude pictures of her, and they were like she showed them at galleries, and she was in Playboy when she was a child, and she's in The Tenant. I thought that was really crazy.
Yeah, and I mean, from what I gather, from Jack Nicholson, you know, it's like he's. I question whether or not he was there, and it wouldn't be difficult to cover these things up, you know. It was his house, you know, but these people don't want to be implemented, you know. I question the whole official story, and I feel like there's good reason to. I speculate on what was happening with that. I don't believe the official story of what came out completely. I feel like the girl would have good reason to, you know. I mean, it was like it got found out, and then after the fact, who knows, you know, what happened from there, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's definitely it's strange. I got in an argument at one point with somebody about this, because I don't. It's very difficult to explain why, like, some people react to that situation. Why would you want to know, like, entertain this guy's work knowing that he did something like that? Like, just stay away from it, you know? And it's like, well, I mean, I'm not condoning his behavior. Like, I'm not condoning Manson's behavior by looking into what the fuck happened. It's more of like, I mean, you could argue that there's kind of a morbid type of side to it, which is kind of entertaining something, but I feel like I just want to understand what the fuck is going on. Like, I feel like there is some...
Claire Quilty is in many forms.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like there was a manipulation that took place on a massive scale. And so I want to understand what that manipulation was. And the only way to do that is to look into it. And so, you know, I have to, like, get as objective a view as possible. And as long as I'm, you know, completely just reactive, it's hard to get a scope on what's taking place. Like, I can't let my, you know, emotional response cloud my vision of what's actually going on. And so it's just, that's the way it is, you know, I can't help it. And I'm looking into what I'm looking into because there's something to it. If there was nothing to it, I wouldn't keep looking into it, you know. So, whatever.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I always have to know why everything, you know, every little thing, I won't rest until I know why.
Yeah, I mean, there's something going on. And, you know, and it doesn't work for me to just
turn, no, you've turn been around. Given a riddle to solve, definitely. And that's the riddle of human existence.
Yeah. I mean, the idea of Marilyn Manson is dichotomy, that you have a woman who was put on a pedestal that was basically worshipped as an idol. And, you say Marilyn Monroe and everybody loves her to death, you know, and she was miserable and she killed herself, you know, and like you have somebody who is just the absolute epitome of like, there is a major charge on, you say Charles Manson. Like, I was looking for Helter Skelter in a bookstore and I asked where Helter Skelter would be. And the guy was like, Manson. And I was like, yeah, Manson. Like, and it was like, it was charged. Like, he's like, true crime section is over here, and kind of like gave me kind of like a weird kind of look for a second. And I'm just like, wow, to even like mention that you're interested in an area of history is like, you know, kind of like inquisitive, like what's the deal? You know, it's like, it's got such a, such an intense charge. It's really something. Yeah. It's like as if to look into it is condoning it or something, and that's not where I'm coming from. I don't think it's a good thing, but it's definitely a thing.
Yeah.
I don't know.
In a Clockwork Orange way of things only being real when you vidy them on the screen.
Yeah, the real world only becomes really real when you see it on the screen. It's like it really works that way, and people don't pay attention to people unless they're speaking to them through the box.
All right, so Alex is Rosemary's little baby, and he's watching all of these scenes of violence on the TV until he gets the message. And
yeah,
that's what you guys are all going to have to keep doing.
Right. I loved, there was like some...
until you stop choosing Barabbas.
There was a speech that Marilyn Manson gave where he showed up on a screen to give the speech, because he said at the beginning of it, he's like, people only listen to people when they're speaking to them through the box. So I'm going to speak to you through the box, so I'll have more authority. And I think that there's a lot of truth to that. It's like something takes on something else when it's been recorded and projected. It's kind of weird that it works that way, but it does. You know.
Maybe it's yes. Like, always through a mediator, you know? Yeah. There has to be a man out there to, you know, tell you that he's seen the truth, and then you can get that truth through him, and that's the whole Buddha on the road thing.
Yeah. So what
as a mediator.
So what is the Moonchild in your view?
Well, the Moonchild is someone who's outside the influence of the moon, or who's attained a higher spiritual state, as opposed to the normal children of earth and flesh.
Okay, that makes sense, because if you're saying that the meaning of the Messiah is that he's, that the meaning of the virgin birth is that he's not coming from the same place that everyone else is coming from, that he's like the outside factor, right? And so, yeah, that makes sense to me, because the moon is influencing the emotional forces of the planet, right? That's the idea, at least, that it's pulling right. the tides and it's pulling ourselves, and that the moon child is the one who's basically above or beyond that influence.
Yeah, they're no longer influenced by the currents of the world, specifically.
Right, and so, and then the relationship of the Sun King to the Moon Child seems like the Sun King is the same thing as the Moon Child. It's just the way that it's reflected in the dream. That the Sun King is also beyond, I mean, that's the meaning of the Messiah, right? That the Sun King is beyond the influence of the astrological forces, right? He's
the man of Tifereth who has to kill himself.
Right, and that's on top of it. That's
the Yellow King.
Okay. See, so tell me more about your ideas around that, because I'm curious of what your take is. Because I mean, I get the idea looking at your blog, but I just want to hear it from you.
Which part?
What you're just continuing on with what you were saying there, because that seems pretty key.
Be specific.
Well, I just want to know, like, if you're looking at what the Sun King is communicating, if you say,
okay, well, like the Beatles fans are the girls at the foot of the cross looking up at Jesus as John Lennon, who's sacrificing himself for them,
right?
And you know, praying to him and saying, "Dear John, forgive us our sins."
Yes,
without knowing that they should themselves nail that figure to the cross and overthrow the wizard behind the curtain.
Yeah. So I, like, this is the thing. So if I was to say that Rosemary's Baby is the Moon Child, if I was to make such an assertion, which I'm not even sure if I would necessarily, I would say that it's what Rosemary's Baby is something. It's something that's unseen, and it's something that's only inferred, and that whatever it is that's being created, like that's the point. Is it's when, if one was to look at it, one would find it extremely disturbing at first glance. But in recognition that it's come from you, it takes on a different meaning. And, like, I feel like there's something that's communicated at the end of Rosemary's Baby when she realizes the futility of her continued, aversion to something that she helped to manifest. And that, like, society itself created something, that something was born out of something, and that we all took part in something, whether we know it or not. And what came out of that is something that, on one level, is disturbing, but on another level is our own creation. And so and there's a conspiracy that's involved in its creation. And so that's what we're reacting to. But that we're all part of that conspiracy too. And so it lends itself to paradox, because we have to own what we've created, whether we like it or not. And that there's a, like I said, there's a futility.
Well, I'm not sure I quite agree with that, but that's kind of what's going on with the two versions of it. Where in the first Rosemary's Baby, it's like the devil child, but in the second one, it's like a perfect creation by mixing heavenly and beastly elements together to create something new.
Right. Well, she's the heavenly element. What Mia Farrow is being communicated as, she's like the virgin, right? So there's a pure side, and then there the people involved in the conspiracy are the dark side. Just like in the book
right.
Moon Child, you have the White and the Black Lodge.
And right, so, but then in the new movie, it's the other side of the tree, where you've got the lower daughter who is rising up to the higher worlds,
right.
And this has to enlist the aid of the satanic element.
Right, but my issue with whatever happened to Rosemary's Baby is that you have the, like, Man Ray doll becomes Rosemary. So that film seems to be, like, communicating like the flip side of what's already flipped, if you catch my drift. Like,
it's, not really.
Well, in the sense that, you know, what Mia Farrow is made to represent in the original Rosemary, I actually take to be a representation of the Shaquina, whereas I take Patty Duke's character as Rosemary to be the handmaiden. So that it's like a reversal of a reversal, so to speak.
But she gets expunged from the picture. So it's more like she goes into exile, and then the other mother takes her place as the mother of Adrian. So I don't really think that works.
Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying. It's tricky. I guess I have.
But at the same time, it seems to me that Adrian is caught between his two girls, where Rosemary in that is more like the Bina figure, and then the other kind of slutty mother is the Malkuth mother. And then the blonde girl, who's the granddaughter of Minnie and Roman, is the Lilith character.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, I guess I take Valley of the Dolls into account so much when I'm approaching whatever happened to Rosemary's baby, that I might be coming from a different place due to that. I see whatever happened to Rosemary's baby is almost like a perfect made-for-TV mixture of Valley of the Dolls and Rosemary's Baby. I take Valley of the Dolls into account when approaching that film, specifically Patty Duke's role as Judy Garland. And so she herself becomes this other thing, you know.
Right.
But yeah, I can see where you're coming from. I think that does make sense. The point being, like you say, that it's a mixture of heaven and earth, and that's the child in the first place, and that I don't believe that what is being communicated, at least metaphorically, of what the child is made to represent is something that's actually embodied. Like, I don't think that I feel just like the age of Horus is actually like an energy, as described by Jack Parsons, so that what is being born is literally a type of consciousness.
Right.
And then you have that it's both things at once. It continues on with the conspiratorial dark mass side to it, but simultaneously there's a liberative aspect as well, and that's the duality that you're confronted with at the end of Rosemary's Baby, is this absolute horror at the thing, no pun intended, and, you know, this kind of, like, understanding that, well, this is what is, and what is, and what am I supposed to do about that? And it came out of me. I look at Rosemary like she's literally the public, who's, like, basically, we've contributed to something. And although there's a conspiracy involved in creating it, we still are the ones who created it through our playing along, unconsciously or not, you know, and then we have to accept it because there's no other alternative. It's like, well, this is what we created. So be it, you know. You get where I'm coming from with that?
I suppose you could take the new miniseries as being in that direction.
Yeah, I wonder. I'm really curious to see what's going on there. I mean, the thing is like these things, these continuations. You have a made-for-TV movie, and then you have a miniseries. I feel like those are a continuation on an idea, but I simultaneously take Rosemary's Baby on its own. And it's, I have like different ways of relating. If I'm going to tie those in, then I can approach the other from a different scope. But I feel simultaneously that what the thing was trying to communicate at the time can stand alone in the midst of those, or they can be incorporated into its meaning. But the meaning, where it went from there is another matter. You see what I mean? Like, it's like an art piece can stand by itself, even if the artist continues to do pieces that relate to it. Then you can tie them in after the fact, or you could take the original in its own terms. I don't know. I see the What's that?
Write it down for me sometime, and I'll think about it.
Right. Well, I mean, it's pretty straightforward. I just can take it on its own terms, or I can see it through the lens of what's come after the fact. Do you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It's really a simple point, really. It's not too complex. But what is a little more complex is because I approach Rosemary's Baby and the White Album as like almost like a seal of something that of a ritual that was started. It's kind of like a closing ceremony, you know, like when you do a banishing ritual. But instead of banishing, in this case, it's an invocation. It's the end of an invocation. So it ends on a note that it's like you can see something's continuing on. But in the context of when that film came out and what was subliminally being communicated, I think that there's something to be said for what the masses is processing and what we're contributing to. In terms of revolution, so that, you know, that the revolution that we saw, that we were trying for, like her fighting the warlocks and the witches as conspirators, is like the public fighting the powers that be, and that in the end the powers that be end up winning and we're forced to concede. But then what is first seen as horrifying, there's beauty that's seen in it as well, or at least there's acceptance of what it is for what it is. I mean, that baby came out of her, you know, and it's a mixture of, you know, of heaven and earth.
Yeah. Okay. I can see that. Yes. It's Bina as Ben-Yah. And so after the impulse Fakma, there's this whole world that's been spun out from her. And that's something that needs to be taken care of, whether she wants it or not.
Yeah, she's in a she only has one. It's a one way option. She doesn't have the other option. Like, she's fighting and fighting and fighting, and then she's like, "Oh well, really, what am I going to do?" And so it's just like, you know, the position that the public found itself in. It's like, what are we supposed to do? Look at this is what it is. This is what we. It's like uncle. You're like having your arm twisted, and you're like, "Okay, I give up," you know. I mean, she takes the knife and it gets placed in the wood, and then she rocks the baby to sleep, you know. So yeah, it's very strange.
Yeah, I was mentioning that in 1968, the Rolling Stones released their song "Child of the Moon." Thought that was pretty interesting.
Yes,
actually. The Rolling Stones, they made a promo film for Child of the Moon, and it was directed by Michael Lindsay Hogg, the son of Orson Welles.
Hi.
He also directed the Beatles promo films for Paperback Writer and Rain, and he did Hey Jude and the whole Let It Be film.
Lindsay Lohan?
Yeah, and Mark Lindsay Chapman, who played John Lennon in Chapter 27.
Huh? Did you see Mr. Nobody yet?
I started watching that, and yeah, it's about the Nemo again.
Yeah,
Captain Nemo.
Yeah,
and in that one, it's about one guy who has all these different parallel lives. So again, it's like the one immortal man or something.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like. A kind of mocking inversion of that, because the one immortal man is the one man who isn't immortal.
Right.
In that movie.
Totally. Exactly. Exactly.
So it's like making fun of Philip K. Dick by making him the exact opposite?
Yeah, it's a reversal. They did such a good job with that. I was really impressed. And it wasn't what I expected, you know, but how often are things what you expect? But, like, yeah, I approached that with, like, this could be interesting to, like, wow. And it actually reminded me a lot of Inception. It was like and it also reminded me of Cloud Atlas in a way. But that's beside the point, what it reminded me of. It was just, it was pretty phenomenal. I was impressed.
I was just going to watch that last night, but I got a gig and I had it to be finished, so I didn't get a chance to watch that, but I was going to watch it tonight. And I noticed on the DVD cover, the tagline for the film is, "Nothing is real, so everything is possible."
Yeah, Strawberry Fields, totally. And, like, it's not, come on, Mr. Nobody, Nowhere Man. Like, it's totally just continuing.
Well, and then that movie, he's always pining after a girl named Anne, and then Anna, and then in Bowie's Repetition, there's that line, "He could have married Anne with the blue silk blouse."
Uh-huh.
From Johnny.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So it's like in a parallel life for our one immortal man, he'll be with Anne instead of with the Asian girl.
Hmm.
Yoko.
Totally.
So he's
totally.
also got his Yoko wife. He's got the blonde, he's got the brunette, he's got the Asian girl.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and there's almost like, I mean, how many characters is he portraying? Is it four?
I didn't finish the movie, so
I think it might be. Sure. I think it might be four, which would be really interesting, right? But like, so I wish I could find the original version of Chapter 27 because they took out what 50 fucking minutes or something like that. It's ridiculous. Like, it was a long, long film. And they were like, oh, this won't, people don't want to watch this. I'm like, I want to watch that. Where's the fucking, where's the extended cut?
Well,
fucking...
Mr. Nobody is like almost 3 hours long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's a shorter version too. But the other one is available. They never made the other version of Chapter 27 available, as far as I know.
Yeah.
I looked and looked for it. I can't fucking find it. I can't run any sync experiments with it either because of that, because I want the
original.
Remember
that 27 is the moon number.
Hmm. How so?
Yeah, I want to watch Chapter 27 with I Know Who Killed Me, but with like the original Chapter 27.
Yeah.
Because if you watch it the way it is, it syncs up pretty well, but I would like to see the original cut of Chapter 27 with that.
So that's with Lindsay Lohan? Is that the deal?
Yeah, and her name is Dakota.
Shit. Shit. Totally.
She plays an identical twin in that film, and it was Jude who convinced Mark David Chapman to buy a copy of Double Fantasy. So you got that.
Shit. Yeah, that's weird.
Do you want me to say something about that?
Yeah.
So I noticed previously that it's like the same kind of shots are in Lana's Tropico, but then the first scene in that is set in Eden, and it looks like the Sgt. Pepper cover, and then after then there's the apple there, and so that whole thing is kind of tying into that. But you know,
have you seen Full Circle, Jason?
Yes.
Yeah, watch it with Double Fantasy. But like,
what is the point of sorry. I mean, what are you going to say?
It's just there's so much there. It's really something. I don't know. It's relatable. The whole fucking apple thing with David Bowman, and it's like,
and of course Dave Bowman is David Bowie again.
Yeah, I mean, I hear what you're saying. I've never really been that big of a David Bowie fan. I like David Bowie's music a lot, but I haven't really like explored his discography too much.
Well, that's the thing, because does it matter? Because I mean, he made Never Let Me Down, and that's a terrible album, and he made Tin Machine, that's a terrible album, but they're still synky.
Right, they're synky as anything. Yeah, totally. He's ultra synky, and like, yeah, and he's doing an interesting thing. He's playing the glam rock figure, which is what Marilyn Manson was portraying with Mechanical Animals, is totally a David Bowie.
Well, right, reference. And so with Manson and Gaga, they're just copying what he's doing, what he was doing, not really in an original sort of way.
I would say that they're juxtaposing what he's doing, or they're continuing on with a theme. More than just, I mean, yes, everything's a copy of a copy, but, well, I wouldn't think that if I mean, I would agree with you more, except for the fact that I feel like there's more merit that comes out in their work in regards to the specific alignments that they created. And so it changes the context a little bit. And I see it, like, this is the thing, Jason, like, I approach these things on their own terms in, when it relates to a specific, it's very specific, it's context specific, it's context dependent. And so, like, I'm not, like, I can see the value of the way, like, what you're doing, like, the way that these people, what's happening with their, either their popularity or the, their amount of influence or these different things, but I approach their specific albums in a specific way to a specific film. And so that changes things for me in regards to all of that, because I, and that's what interests me more than their public reception. Though I recognize the value of that as well. It's just not how I'm oriented when it comes to analyzing their work. Does that make sense?
Sure, sure.
Okay. Yeah, and so it's like it's all on its own terms, especially with Manson and Gaga, because if it wasn't for those specific alignments, I would totally be with you on that, like, this is a copy of a copy, because those people are a copy of something in the first place. Like, Madonna's a copy. You say someone's copying Madonna, it's like Madonna, as much as people would say, oh, that, like, she's original, she's taking from archetypes, and so they're just continuing on with the archetype. I would say it's more of proceeding or staying on a theme than it is just necessarily mimicking, because they're bringing something else into play by what they're doing. And you can see what their inspirations are too. People are inspired by people's work, or they're fans of their work. Like, I think Manson was a fan of Bowie, and that's what that came out of, you know. Or that,
well, right. I didn't mean my statement as a criticism. I just meant that as a fan of those two people, you should see some commonality with Bowie's work.
Right.
As well.
Right. I don't think I would have. Stay, like, when I was young and I listened to Marilyn Manson's music, if it wasn't for Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and Portrait of an American Family, absolutely blew my mind when it came out, you know. And, like, if it wasn't for that, would I have continued to listen to Manson? Probably not. And if it wasn't for my Jesus Christ Superstar, Antichrist Superstar discovery, I wouldn't have been as fascinated. And that's what kept me on the chain, was those specific kind of like explosive realizations for me, you know. And it's personal, because it was an experiential thing of like figuring of decoding something, and so something was decoded and there was an exhilaration that came with that realization, partially just because no one else is fucking talking about it, and I'm just like, why isn't anyone else talking about this? Like, it's surprising to me in a way. Like, I'm like, I can't believe that it's not just like, especially like the Jesus Christ, Antichrist Superstar thing. That should be fucking common knowledge. I mean, it's at an odd starting point. It's when the bus door opens, but still, like, it's after the fact, it's so apparent. It's kind of like what our last guest was talking about, where you're talking about the stock market and can you predict these things? It's like, well, after the fact, it's a lot easier to put it together than it is beforehand. Like, to predict something that's going to happen is a lot different than after something's happened, figuring out how it happened. You know, it's a different process involved. It takes a lot more to be able to see into the future than to understand the past, you know?
Yeah, sure.
Cool.
I didn't mean to accuse you of anything.
Oh, no, I didn't think you were accusing me of something. I see that there's a kind of a difference in where it is, of how it is that you're approaching these people portraying archetypes. Because it's their specific art pieces, I feel, are incomplete on their own level. Like, I don't think Gaga's album Stand Alone is anything even the slightest bit, I don't feel like it has any, like, artistic integrity on its own terms. I don't think it has any artistic value if you take it by itself. Yet, with some specific correspondence is, every line takes on a different meaning. And so, you know, that's like, if you watch, you know, Marie Antoinette, and you see when Bloody Mary is playing, and she's saying dom dom da da dom, as the bloodhounds are running by, it's like she's saying blood over and over again in Hebrew. I mean, there's a number of times where she says Hebrew terms, and without, they're not as obvious if you don't see the context in which they're being presented and how they align with the films. You can see what's going on. Like the song Judas, you know, you're watching Marie Antoinette getting married to a Jew, and, you know, as a king, you know, a king without a crown, you know, because he's not a king yet. And it's there, and it's relatable, and you can see, and like, the camera goes by the rooster at the top of the bed. It's like this golden rooster, and it's Judas. Fucking the cock crows three times. It's like, boom, there you go. Bam, she hit it. You know, and so I'm impressed.
Yeah, no, they definitely seem to hit on things that I kind of arrived at independently of doing the movie sync-ups. And so usually they just seem to kind of confirm some of the insights that I would get just by watching the movie.
Yeah, it's ultra confirming.
Yeah.
And so that's a thing too. Like, I mean, you know, I at one point on this show, Amy and I sat down to watch Alien, and I'm like, okay, let's look at this film from a Freudian perspective. Just keeping that in mind, knowing that the alien is made to represent a penis, you know, obviously. And so, you know, we're watching the film, I'm like, this movie is about fucking birth trauma. And like, and so I put that together, and, you know, it seemed like the subtext of the film, that the ship gets impregnated, and then the ship is called Mother, and then, you know, there's basically either an abortion or a birth at the end, where there's a screaming baby that gets kicked out, and the only thing that's saved is Sigourney Weaver and her pussy, you know? And I was approaching it in that way, and then I watch, after the fact, I watch a Rob Agger interpretation of Alien, and the whole thing is about how this is about birth trauma. And then just the other day, Amy's supervisor pointed out to her that H.R. Giger, who just died, had level 4 birth trauma. Like the most severe birth trauma you could have, basically, without dying, from what I gather. And, I mean, I had birth trauma. I came out backwards, and I was completely blue, and they rushed me away, and it took a long time before I was returned to my mom, but that's completely beside the point. But the idea being is that, like, this guy experienced the worst birth trauma imaginable, and here he seems to be doing the artistic side for a film, which he got an Oscar for. That subtext I came at to see as birth trauma, and then I see somebody else completely independently came up with the same idea, and I guess the reason being is that it's fucking there. Like, it seems like it's there, as far as I can tell. And so, you know, that's affirming. If anything, it's just an affirming thing, because I made a connection, somebody else made the connection, you know, and we came to it through different means. Like, I just came across a writer, I can't remember his name, he's kind of this, he's anti-Zionist, but I think he's got some other weird shit going on too. He's with James Shelby Downer, he contributed to the King Kill 33, but some of his writings talking about Mark David Chapman and Roman Polanski and all this stuff, he's over here talking about the Golem and all these things, but he came at the same ideas that I came to through an entirely different route. And like that, I don't see that as like a type of competition or anything. I just see that as like an affirmation, you know. It's very affirming to see somebody else coming to the same realizations through a different means, you know.
Hmm. No, we're converging on a point. So, is there anything more to say?
Oh, we're converging on a point. Yeah, no, I don't know.
In more ways than one, as far as this conversation goes.
Sure.
And I see exactly what you're saying.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, I mean I don't know what the purpose is. I don't know if it's just like entertainment for them on a certain level, or if it's actual programming, or if it's just it seems like it's just the excitement of being on the inside. Like, they like, musicians like, and artists in general, like to be able to present something and have a meaning that everyone is accepting as the meaning, and then have another meaning that's behind that, that they're all sharing in. And I mean, that seems to be the case in a lot of these instances, that it's just, I don't know what exactly they're getting out of that.
I don't necessarily have a conspiratorial point of view on this.
That's fine. I didn't, in certain cases, and I can name the specific ones, I lean towards a conspiratorial point of view. But at the same time, I also think that there's something to be said for people just playing with archetypes, and the way that once you open something up, it leads to this and this, and they're probably aware of that. That not all of it even has to be intentional, but even if part of it is, it is designed in such a way to lead you on to other things. I think Kubrick was really notorious for that. Just throwing something in there, which he knows to connects to fucking 50 other things. And so why not toss it into the mix so that people will be left basically researching further into a specific area and coming to more understanding. And there's a really strong argument for that, like his whole Golden Bough obsession that he was very direct about. You know, like I've said before, just I read in a Vanity Fair article where he gave the head of Warner Brothers his copy of the unabridged Golden Bough, and basically called him every couple of weeks and asked him if he'd gotten into it. And the guy said, "I don't have time for mythology." And Kubrick said, "This isn't mythology. This is your life." Like, obviously he took the anthropological meaning of that to heart. And if he took it to heart like that, why wouldn't he include it in his films? Especially when you see that he's included the Red Book as a subtext, admittedly so, with Full Metal Jacket. And so, and then included the Red Book on Ullman's desk in The Shining. That's like more than just a hint. That's like, hey, everybody, this is the subtext. And so,
well, I would never deny that.
Right. I mean, starting out with a subtext and building a story around it. And so, in that sense, that's what I mean by conspiratorial, is because he has his own.
Well, these are literary devices and such.
Right. But it's kind of like Jesus's parables in a way, because you have a meaning that's for the masses that they're all relating to, thinking they knew what the film is about, when really the film's about something else entirely, or that embedded in that meaning there's something deeper. And I think that goes on quite a bit. And I feel that some specific album film syncs are kind of doing the same thing, where they are a type of subtext in the way that, you know, the Seder chorus in The Birth of Tragedy, that's the whole point of the chorus, is that they're communicating the, you know, the sub-meaning of what's going on, and that takes the forefront of the stage, so that it's literally drowning out the sound of the play, and everyone's familiar with the play, and so but it becomes the medium through which they can relate to the material, so that what would normally be the what's underneath is actually on top. And that's what happens with these. It's the exact same phenomenon.
Oh, lucky man. The Greek chorus, you know, the band that's doing the soundtrack is in the film.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, no, I know. I completely had the exact same kind of realization there. It is very relatable in that way. Yeah, you have it's very similar to like the monolith being the screen. It's like you're watching a band that's like, you know, you don't realize that they're going to be in the film as you're watching it. For them to be in the film, it changes the context in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah, like you're in the thing watching the thing watching yourself, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy how McDowell, he actually interacts with the band making the soundtrack, you know? Kind of makes me feel like the Oh Lucky Man is sort of like a film version of a concept album. And like the characters are like subjects in a song, like Mr. Kite and Lovely Rita, and then they're interchangeable and they can interact with each other. And like the two halves of the film are like the two sides of a record.
Totally. Yeah. No, I couldn't agree more. I totally see that. Yeah, it is like a theme album. It's like you're watching an album unfold. And you know, like if you listen to like the lyrical content of like the songs, especially like "Oh Lucky Man" itself. You know, I mean the it's like the title. You know how like an album will often be named the title song. You know, yeah. It's like that phenomenon, you know, it's like, it's kind of similar in a way. It's like Magical Mystery Tour, you know, it's like
Sergeant Pepper.
Yeah, exactly. And so, and also the fact that the songs that you're listening to are the subtext of the film itself, because they're communicating through music and you see that it's relatable and it's direct, but it's not direct in the same way. It's not like they're saying the characters' names in the song or anything. It's like, but you can see how it relates to what's going on. And so it's very similar, like, for real. Yeah, and you watch that film and it takes a second sometimes to realize how it relates of what it is that they're saying to what's going on with the characters, you know. It's direct, but it's not too direct, which is very similar.
Exactly.
Hmm. Okay, I guess I was gonna look at this thing that Jason Pereira put up over here. I don't have to say his last name when he's here, although he's not here at the moment.
Wait, sorry, what?
I was trying to click on your Mask of God where you're talking about Gaga because you say you touched on this. It always takes a second.
Well, I connected it to Marie Antoinette somehow.
Oh, really? Just
independently. So that's just what I was...
Oh, nice. Yeah, I mean, I look up, I just, as an experiment, after I put the sync together, I looked up just what happens if I type in Lady Gaga, Marie Antoinette, and what I got was a ton of pictures of her with the hair of Marie Antoinette. and just, like, she dresses up like the Gollum from Metropolis. It's with her hair, you know, it's very similar to like the headdress thing that she was wearing. You know, it's like she's playing on the part that she's communicating what's going on there. And so I'm saying goodbye to Amy. Bye. And then I saw that with like, you know, Marilyn Manson's Hollywood and Holy Mountain. You know, I watched the woman in that who's, she's not Venus, what is she, Saturn or something, I think she was Saturn, the one with the toy business, you know, and like, I look at her, immediately when I saw that woman, when I first watched that movie, I was like, that's Marilyn Manson's outfit, he's gotten dressed up as her, so it's like, they're literally like playing the part of the character in the sync that they put together, and it's so funny that way, you know. They get, and it's fun to play dress up. It's because they're identified with the characters, you know. It's like with Metropolis, she's like, I love that lavender blonde, you know, the way she moves, the way she walks, you know, she's taking on the role because it she's identified with it. Just like with you know, Carrie and Live Through This, you know, Courtney Love, literally, like, I put that together before realizing that in one of the songs, she says, Carrie, Carrie, please come here, don't you touch me, don't you dare, we look the same, we talk the same, we are the same, we are the same. And so you can see that she's literally identified with the character that she, so it's like, that's part of it. In the same way, when you look at Greek tragedy, when they would play a part, they're literally like, it's like to act out a part is to take on the spirit of the thing. It's a type of invocation. And so in a sense, it's like literally a ritual invocation of the archetype that they're trying to portray. They're doing their best to embody said archetype.
Right. Well, that would be my whole point. Exactly.
Yeah. It seems like that's what you're communicating over and over again in your own way. And so I feel like there's definitely something extremely complementary about what we're doing, and I actually appreciate the fact that you're working on such different lines, because it just becomes all the more affirming to come at the same thing through a different route, you know. And if you came to it through the same route, it wouldn't be fun.
Well, people seem to be somehow more receptive to pop culture from 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And I guess that's just how it goes.
Yeah, I'm scrolling through your page right now trying to find where you make this Gaga connection with Marie Antoinette. Is it towards the bottom or something?
Some of the videos might be broken. I don't know.
Oh, I see. Polanski flees Wanted and Desired. Yeah,
like broken teeth, you know?
Yeah. So, oh man, cut you like a fish. What did you just find with that recently, Patrick? You posted something with that scene. I can't remember what it was that you were pointing out.
Which scene?
The Polanski, cut you like a fish, when he slices Jack Nicholson's nose.
There's a couple things about that. Well, you know Polanski's film Knife in the Water. In Polish, the word knife is pronounced nos. So, like, in Chinatown, he cuts Jack Nicholson's nose with a knife. So it's like, he cuts his nose with a nose.
Right, a rosy nose.
Yeah.
Oh,
and
no.
Then Andras was talking about the Draper girl in Mad Men having a bandage on her nose, like Jack in Chinatown. And then I mentioned Alex in A Clockwork Orange with the bandage on his nose, and how he's backed into a corner by the policeman, just like in If, when he's backed into the corner while he's fencing with his friend and he cuts his hand.
Yeah, totally. Or when, you know, what happens? He gets punched in the face or something in O Lucky Man when he's being interrogated by his father in A Clockwork Orange, and the way that he's holding, where he has his bloody lip, and the way that he's dealing with, like, it's this reoccurring theme that's running throughout it, for sure. Yeah, I totally see that. It's weird. So, yeah, the fact that he makes the fish reference, and what was the thing with the goldfish and the omen? The goldfish falls off the balcony with the mother or something? I can't remember.
Yeah.
Is that what it is? Yeah.
That was it.
Okay, yeah. There's something going on.
The secret goldfish from The Catcher in the Rye.
Tell me about that, because I can't remember.
The secret goldfish?
Yeah, yeah.
It's just a little story he has in The Catcher in the Rye about a secret goldfish that the kid worked for. They wouldn't let anyone see because he bought it with his own money.
Huh.
Obviously, like, the goldfish represents the self, and the kid is like the rejuvenated personality as opposed to a shadow figure.
Right. Is there someone new on the line?
Yep.
I thought somebody jumped on the line.
And Dillinger is dead, and Anita Pallenberg looks into her goldfish bowl and, like, makes faces at them and stuff for, like, no apparent reason.
Huh. And isn't there, like, the goldfishes in, yeah, there is, in Poltergeist, and the little girl is feeding the goldfish way too much, and yes, maybe it's just because it's emphasizing the same point again of gold, that it's like the sun. It's like the goldfish becomes a symbol of the sun or something in Pisces or something. I don't know. Pisces is ruled by the moon, right? Isn't that the deal? Sun and moon.
The moon card is attributed to Pisces.
Right, but isn't Pisces itself ruled by the moon, or am I mistaken? I thought that the sign of Pisces was corresponded to the moon, but I
don't know anything about astrology.
Okay, is it?
You have to Google it.
Well, Jason, do you know? Is Pisces ruled by the moon?
Let me Google that for you.
Yeah, look at us. I thought we were supposed to know all this stuff. Well, we're no longer experts in our fields, I guess.
Cancer is ruled by the moon. Pisces is ruled by Neptune.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, I know that there's the reoccurring ones, like Gemini is ruled by Mercury, and so is, there's two ruled by Mercury, I can't remember. God, I used to have all of this. I don't know what happened. I guess it turned into short-term knowledge somehow, but. Oh, Virgo. Virgo and Gemini are both ruled by Mercury. Ancient goldfish history, huh? What do you got? Something. Oh, it's you. It's interesting when you make a link to your blog is so lengthy that I never know. Oh, you put this one up on September 11th, 2011, I see.
Well, I didn't.
Oh, this is the sinkhole? I see. Okay. But it seems like your blog is mostly just you now. Like, you have all these contributors, myself included, that haven't been contributing. Is that true? Is no one else really doing much? Are you kind of, like, winging it?
I added Eugene recently. He's been putting some stuff.
Has he? Even in your recent one?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Yeah, I mean, this is a thing. Like, Mark LeClaire made the statement to me. He's like, I don't know how you have time to do all of this. It's like, if I had time, I'd be doing a whole lot more than I'm doing. And one of the things I'd be doing is contributing to Mask of God and Blog of Caverns. But I only have so much I can do with my free time. It's one of those things, you know. I really was excited to contribute more, but then it was just like it didn't really work that way in practice.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, this like back and forth between room 237 and the room in 2001 is kind of interesting.
Oh, well, that's just taken from John Phil Ryan, I guess.
Hmm. Huh. Fuck.
Oh, it's not that great.
What, this blog? I mean,
it was good when he did it.
This entry?
It's not good when I stole it.
Okay. Well, I like it. I like just following through and looking back and forth. It's kind of fun. Yeah, I had the opportunity. My dad came to visit for one day to do some business stuff from Idaho, and I showed him the end of The Shining with the Doors, the end, and it's his favorite song of all songs ever is The Doors, the end, which is kind of funny to like watch with my father, you know, Father, I want to kill you, you know, and it's like his favorite song with The Shining. It was just like, whoa.
Well, that's answering the riddle of the Sphinx again.
Well, exactly. And that's the thing.
I mean, Oedipus was the one who solved the riddle right. Of man.
Totally. Yeah, absolutely.
So that's how you do it, by killing the father.
Right. It's so direct. And you can see the way that it plays out. The Shining is totally has this Greek tragedy element that's very direct. Yeah, no question there as far as I'm concerned. I think maybe we're reaching the end here. I think we've recorded for, you know, almost 4 hours. So
is that a new record?
No, definitely not. We've had shows, I think, that have gone for like maybe 5 to 6 hours before. So
it's at 3:27. So you want to stop it here before?
Well, it's not really, because there's another recording that's on top of this one from when we first started before you jumped on. So, it'll get changed anyways in editing probably.
You have a real talent for talking for endless amounts of time. I couldn't ever do that much.
Yeah, well, a lot of it is just kind of restating assumptions and restating ideas in order to work them into new ideas. Because without restating what's already been said, you can't really keep going. And so I think Bill sometimes saw that as regurgitation, whereas I relate to it more like Max and Pi. You know, it's like, restate my assumptions. The universe is made of numbers. If you graph the numbers of any system, patterns emerge. Therefore, there are patterns everywhere, you know, et cetera. And so, like, I feel like that's a kind of a scientific approach in a way, because in order to have a hypothesis, you have to stay on a line, you know, in order to continue with a hypothesis. And so that's a lot of what we're doing here. But a lot of new things got said today still, and I feel good about the show. I think it'll be... I'm going to have to maybe edit it a little bit more than usual, just because of some technical difficulties and stuff, but I feel good about it. Thank you for attending. I really appreciate it. I'd love to do it again sometime.
I needed more coffee than I had on hand at the time, so I'm sorry.
Well, I don't know. I like I said, I had to slap myself awake in order to do this, so that's not always the best way to go about this kind of thing. But I think that, I really like this. I'd like to have both you guys on again at the same time again if you're into it. And so, yeah, guys, I'd say have a good day. Is there anything else you wanted to contribute before we go? I think that the tags will be included for your blogs and whatnot, so, and most people should be familiar with those in the first place, but if you want to say something, now's the time.
I'm good. Had a good time today.
Good. Awesome.
All right, love one another, and good day to you.
Okay. All right, take it easy, guys. Thanks. Da-dunch.
Oh, he's still there.
Is this a fake hang-up? This is a fake hang-up.
But yeah, Bob.
Okay, I will really hang too. Up.
Bob did have a goldfish. What was that, Jason?
Oh, he's gone.
Oh, he's out. Okay. Well, we could go on talking about Bob's goldfish, or we can drop the call. So
I gotta get stuff done.
Okay, cool. Well, I'll see you later. Thank you.
All right. Yeah, catch you later.
Bye.
Bye.